You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up, as Donald Trump's controversial presidency continues, are the Democrats suffering from a lack of leadership?
The New Yorkers had said to me, you watch his behavior. This is how he operates.
Right.
And you judge it. First, he will try to charm you. If that doesn't work, he bullies you. If that doesn't work, he walks away from you.
We'll ask why some are calling for the resignation of House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Meanwhile, in Brussels...
Because I think when you speak about not just migrants, but refugees, you speak about people leaving their countries because of a political regime and because they are killed for political reasons. Refugees are part of our DNA.
But they're not on today's agenda, as Emmanuel Macron joins leaders from across the European Union at his first summit as president. Plus, why Robert Mugabe's wife probably won't be the next president of Zimbabwe, how the Afghan army wound up wearing the wrong colour, and lovers of Italian cuisine rejoice. You're now free to bring pesto on board for your flight home. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Hey, warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Martin Plout, a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, University of London, and Jacob Parakilas, assistant head of the US and the Americas program at Chatham House. Gentlemen, welcome both to the program. Very good to have you with us. With resistance to the presidency of Donald Trump seeming to grow in recent weeks, hopes were high that a fresh political newcomer could upset a special House election in Georgia and deliver the traditionally Republican district to the Democrats. But after a surprisingly easy win by the GOP's Karen Handel, Democrats are now wondering whether there's something fundamentally wrong, perhaps with the party's brand. Some have pointed the finger of responsibility at House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Jacob, I'll come to you first of all. Is there always a problem, or sometimes a problem in the US, that after a general election defeat, the defeated party, it asks understandable questions about where to go next, that there can be a bit of a, I guess, a bit of a vacuum at the top?
There's definitely a bit of a vacuum, because at the moment, in terms of national symbols of the Democratic Party, the two logical ones are Nancy Pelosi, who's the House Minority Leader, and Chuck Schumer, who's the Senate Minority Leader. They're both very, very long-standing Democratic politicians. Pelosi is broadly seen as a little bit to the left of Schumer, but they're both sort of well within the mainstream of the Democratic Party. They're very much machine politicians. I should say they're both, in their ways, very, very effective politicians. Part of the reason why there's been all this drama within the Republican Party about the replacement for Obamacare, or the repeal of Obamacare, is that both Pelosi and Schumer have kept their caucuses 100% in line and 100% dedicated to maintaining Obamacare, maintaining the sort of signature accomplishment of the last president. But Pelosi has been around for a while. She was Speaker of the House after the 2006 elections. She lost that chair when the Republican took the House back in 2010. So she's been, you know, in the top seat for the Democrats for over 10 years now. And I think there's a sort of movement, an idea that if the Democrats are going to represent a real alternative to Trump, they need to put somebody new. They need to have a fresh face. Schumer, by contrast, has been around for a long time, but he's only been the minority leader since Harry Reid retired at the end of the last Senate. So he's, I think, relatively insulated from this for the moment. And that's going to continue to be a problem for the Democrats until they have control of at least one House body, because there's still that sort of that absence at the top.
Martin, is that a problem? I mean, I think it's instructive if you consider, you know, what Jacob's saying there about how effective they are in pure political terms, their actual day-to-day function. But is that enough? I mean, if you go out into the country, there was this setback in Georgia, which we mentioned. To connect with, you know, the rank and file, people on the ground, you need someone who's, well, in a sense, that political function is less important than their ability to be the quintessential person you'd rather have a drink with in a bar. I mean, is the Democrats' problem more fundamental than waiting for a change of one of the houses?
Well, I mean, that's what it looks like. I mean, the question is always, you know, who has that feeling of authenticity? And whatever one thinks of Donald Trump, he had authenticity in spades. And in a sense, it's something that he shares with Jeremy Corbyn here in the United Kingdom, that both of them were authentic politicians, you know, and they're not the only ones. You know, there are quite a few people who come over as the real deal rather than the machine politician. And perhaps we've got to a stage now where we are the glossy personality who never makes a mistake and is terribly cautious. Theresa May here, for example, you know, absolutely hones her soundbites to the extent that she only gives the same soundbite 4, 5, 6 times in an interview. And, you know, but on the other hand, you know, one's got to say this, that I believe there were something like 5 different races in the same day. And between them, the Democrats actually put on 8 points. So, you know, it wasn't as if it was a disaster for the Democrats. It's just they didn't win when they expected to.
And that's a really important point, if I can just come in on that, because I think, you know, you described the 6th congressional district in Georgia as traditionally Republican, which I think undersells it a bit. This is the district that Newt Gingrich represented when he was in the House of Representatives. This is one of the most conservative. And the reason why there are these special elections is because the president has picked people who can be replaced safely with Republicans. So he doesn't go to, you don't make the mistake that Obama made a couple of times in picking senators from states who could then be replaced by Republicans in special elections. You pick the people whose seats will be safely held by your own party. So for the Democrats to come within a few points in the 6th District of Georgia, it's not a win, but it's a big step. And it represents, I think, if not an existential, then certainly a worrying threat for the Republicans come next year.
And just to, Jacob, on that point that Martin made about authenticity in politicians, is there a broader question, I guess, about the Democrats? Maybe this is what I'm picking away at, as to, you know, what is the authentic Democrat now? You know, they had obviously a tough time. The defeat to Trump has caused maybe some unpredictable and some fresh challenges. Do you think there is, if not an existential threat, is there a question about fundamentally what it means to be a Democrat today?
I'm going to give a very, very moderate answer to that and say yes and no. Because on the one hand, yes, there's a real debate right now, and it gets oversimplified to the sort of retread of the Bernie versus Hillary fight. Is the Democratic Party a socially democratic party that's going to nationalize healthcare or at least institute single-payer healthcare, or is it a sort of broadly center-left neoliberal party? And I think that obscures a lot of the real dynamics within the Democratic Party, but it's a useful kind of signifier, and it's certainly something that attracts a lot of commentary, particularly on social media. By the same token, as the Republicans found in 2009, 2010, you don't need a single unifying party identity when you're in opposition. Just saying this guy in charge is bad and you should vote against him and you should feel good about voting against him can actually be a really powerful unifying force. It's how the Republicans made massive gains in both the House and Senate in 2010, how they made massive gains in the Senate in 2014. The fact that they could sort of rely on a diversity of views in more conservative states, they could run more conservative Tea Party type senators or candidates, and in more liberal states, they could run more moderate candidates. And that was an effective strategy because the only objective, you're not trying to get a single personality elected, you're trying to pick up seats, you know, in aggregate.
Martin, what do you think the Democrats need to consider as their next objectives? It is interesting, obviously, depending on how you look at their successes or successful moves that they've made recently, you can find undoubtedly silver linings. Is that enough? I mean, you look at 2018, of course, and midterms and these big changes. Will the party have enough momentum to keep everyone on track and look to make significant gains then? Or do you think, whether it's Pelosi or someone else, will need to try and inspire a bit more confidence in the months leading up to that point?
I think the problem is the same for the centre-left everywhere across the globe, which is that their old base in the organised working class has disappeared because, you know, there just isn't that base. It doesn't exist in all the mass factories where you could pick up people. So you have to find a new way of linking the left intelligentsia with the, shall we say, disaggregated person, the Uber car driver. You've suddenly got to give a reason to that person and say, listen, it's not just that we are going to go with the professors and their sons and daughters. We are going to go something for you. And after all, one of the things that you can give people is the sense that you can solve their real long-term doubt, which is pensions. If you could come up with pensions, a pension solution, plus, let's be honest, I think the healthcare bill was a fantastic gain, and it's just beginning to sink in and will eventually, I think, be quite a popular issue. No wonder the Democrats are fighting tooth and nail to save it. then you might have something. But you've got to get to that point.
But if we have social fragmentation, then is not the answer to look beyond the traditional two-party balance? You look at what's happened in France, for example. We'll talk about Emmanuel Macron a little later. You know, that's shaken up this traditional left and right balance. We had neither of the two traditional parties in the runoff for the first time in decades. I mean, are you saying that maybe we need to look at a political recalibration to address some of those?
Well, that's just
social fragmentation.
That's just what's happened in the UK. After all the small parties have fallen away, and you're left with the Tories and the Labour Party.
But in a way, that's the opposite of what's happened.
That's why the situation is so fluid. The old certainties where, you know, I voted X because my dad did or my mother did, have gone. And things can sweep and change at a moment's notice. And that is the great difficulty of now predicting in a circumstance where things are so fluid.
I think it has to be said, though, that the US two-party system is much more deeply entrenched than the party system in France or the UK. It would be really, really difficult for someone to run as a successful, independent presidential candidate, because not only do you actually need to run a campaign that has a sort of unifying message, you need to run 50 separate campaigns, 51, including the District of Columbia. You need to make sure that every single state has an operation staffed with volunteers, with paid professional staff, with pollsters. You need to make sure that you have some connections with the business community, with people who can reinforce your message, with newspaper editors, and, you know, and that stuff is all really, really difficult and time-consuming. The other way to do it is to build up from the grassroots. But there's then the huge question, why try to build a grassroots party when you can just sort of take over or influence one of the existing parties? And that, I think, is why you ended up with UKIP in this country and the Tea Party, which was effectively just amalgamated into the Republican Party in the United States.
So, Jacob, last word. You know, who's going to be the Democrat figurehead then, do you think, over the next, whatever, year and a half or so? Does the party need to have somebody like that?
The party doesn't need a figurehead until 2018. After 2018, it desperately needs a figurehead because there needs to be somebody who can sort of unify these different factions of the party, somebody who the Bernie voters of 2016 and the Hillary voters can agree on, because otherwise you're going to have fragmentation. You're going to have perhaps a sort of, you know, quixotic independent campaign that would steal votes from the left and lead to a minority re-election of Donald Trump. And that's a really hard balance. And we were just saying in the green room that I'm not doing predictions anymore. I can give you a few.
And you never will.
Yeah, we'll see how long that lasts. But I can give you a few names of people who are clearly sort of angling. You know, Kirsten Gillibrand, senator from New York; Elizabeth Warren, senator from Massachusetts; Mario Cuomo, the governor of New York. I mean, there are clearly people who are sort of beginning to position themselves for the presidency, but I don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. So I would be very hesitant to say this is the person who's going to get the crown.
Indeed, a fascinating thing to watch over the next 18 months or so. Leaders from across Europe are gathered in Brussels today at a summit likely to be focused on security issues and Britain's exit from the Union. But the lingering issues of refugees is unlikely to factor quite as heavily as it would have done just a few months ago. Anger has been mounting at countries like Hungary and Poland after their refusal to accept the refugee quota agreed upon by the European Union. One diplomat suggested that the topic would be revisited after the German elections in September. But can the European Union afford yet more inaction on refugee issues? Martin Plough, it's understandable that the EU leadership is sidetracked by Brexit, by concerns about security, which are very immediate, and they preoccupy people in all of the EU bloc. Nevertheless, the refugee issue was the kind of unavoidable, inescapable issue, what, just maybe 12 months ago? And yet they've been explicit that they're not going to address it this time. Is that a mistake?
No. In essence, because they've solved the problem. I mean, that's a gross oversimplification because, of course, they haven't solved the problem. And there are hundreds of thousands of people scattered across all sorts of places like Greece and Italy who would like to go different places. And people are still arriving on the shores. And the Hungarians and the Poles, for example, are just determined they're not going to take any of these people and are going to drag their heels as much as they can. Eventually, they will take some, probably, because the Germans will just say, well, no, you won't get any more money unless you do. So presumably they will take some. But no, the reason I say it's yesterday's issue is that they've solved the problem. They've done a deal with the Turks, which is cutting off the supply from the Syrian end and the Afghans and the Pakistanis. They've done a deal with the southern tribes in southern Libya. They've closed the border in Morocco. They've closed the border in Israel. Egypt is increasingly difficult. Sudan is almost impossible now. There are vast numbers of people bottled up in there, and they're being, frankly, sent back or even killed by the Janjaweed. So in the numbers of coming across the Mediterranean, although they are still high and the death toll is terrible, they are falling. They're going to be maybe half of what they were last year. And, you know, I mean, we can't be sure, but it really looks as if they are falling. So there is a declining problem to deal with. And that is why it's not so pertinent any longer.
Jacob, do you go along with that reading? And is there a risk, I don't know, of, if not complacency, of perhaps relegating this down the, you know, the list of talking points when it should remain, if not front and centre, it should at least be writ large?
Yeah, I basically agree with that. I mean, I think if we define the political problem, and this is a very cynical reading, if we decide the political problem is the sort of the number of people entering and the unknown potential beyond that, and if you sort of read the graph, okay, there were, you know, 100 migrants who crossed the border, X border today, we expect there'll be 150 tomorrow and 200 the day after that. You know, if you're sort of reading that, if that is your definition of the problem, then yes, the problem is not solved, but it's a diminishing problem. Of course, the issue there is that that's not the problem. You have huge issues with, you know, what to do with people sort of stagnating in refugee camps, with unmet funding commitments for taking care of these people, with long-term sort of social cohesion issues, how you manage xenophobia in societies against, you know, newly arrived migrant populations, how in the long term you balance sort of the demands of multiculturalism and democracy against those xenophobic forces. There are lots of problems, but there are problems that are 6 month, a year, 5 year problems. And that means that, you know, in terms of the sort of the action items on the agenda, it's not as pressing as, you know, Russia and Ukraine or Brexit or, you know, how to manage the US withdrawal from the Paris Climate Treaty. So it's something to be dealt with in committees and sort of long-term study groups, not at the sort of forefront of the agenda with foreign ministers.
Martin, I wonder, given how some of those issues actually speak to things like, for example, the Brexit vote, unquestionably immigration was a key issue here, even if it was misunderstood by a lot of the public, I would perhaps argue. Don't some of these questions about how to deal with xenophobia, how to deal with the attitude of citizens within their EU countries to migrants, don't they need to be addressed, though, on a block-wide basis? Or are those problems that can only really be addressed by domestic politicians in their domestic markets?
I mean, yes, of course, they need to be dealt with in both ways, both by the bloc and individually. But, you know, I think that Jacob was right. You know, the politicians deal with what they have to deal with because somebody is sort of standing on their toe. And as soon as they stop standing on it, somebody else is standing on the other toe. And quite frankly, that is what they deal with, the absolutely immediate pressing crisis. And as soon as the crisis is relieved, yes, they push it down the agenda. It becomes the, you know, second secretary's job. And things will happen. I mean, I'm not trying to say that there's going to be any halt to migration. And, you know, I mean, the Germans, after all, have quite successfully dealt with 1 million people. I mean, there aren't vast riots. They don't particularly like it, but it's been dealt with. You know, Britain is still, frankly, absorbing quite a lot of people. So is France. So it is happening, but it's happening less rapidly. And the effort now is definitely to halt people in Niger, halt them in Mali, halt them in Sudan, and stop them, particularly coming across the border from Syria. And I just think that is where the focus is. It is not on absorption.
There's a danger, and I'm sort of pivoting off what Martin said here, because, you know, to use the US example, you had in the 2016 election basically the election where Trump won in the first instance because he staked out the most extreme possible position on immigration. And he did that at a time when immigration was falling, when net migration from Mexico, which was the sort of the boogeyman of immigration, was actually negative. You had more Mexicans going back to Mexico than coming across the border. The issue wasn't the flows, because it has been, you know, the US has been a sort of has had larger migration targets than most European countries, even relative to its size, for a long time. The issue wasn't, in the public mind, it wasn't the flows, even if that was how it was sort of described. We're going to build that wall and stop the flows. Ultimately, the issue in the U.S. was a sort of backlash against social cohesion in a multicultural society. And that's a really thorny question. And it's really difficult to come up with a sort of, especially when you're dealing with 27 separate polities. It's a really, really difficult thing to manage in the long term. And you have to manage it in the long term because you can't just do a short-term solution and assume that'll fix it.
Well, let's continue to talk about challenging longer-term political problems by heading to Zimbabwe next. The nation's aging president, Robert Mugabe, had hoped that his wife might succeed him as the next president. But a warning by the country's intelligence chief seems to have brought about a change of heart. Martin Plough, has Robert Mugabe listened to counsel from somebody for once, or was this just an idea that was never really going to get off the ground?
Robert Mugabe's been one of these politicians who loves to keep everybody on their toes. So he'll move one way one day and one way the next day. And Grace Mugabe, it looks as if she's, you know, suffered a bit of a humiliation, and Gucci Grace, as she's called by her detractors, is you know, she took on the war veterans, and you don't do that. That was a deeply silly thing to do. And, you know, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who's her rival and deputy president. I think personally he's in a much better position to take over because, you know, first of all, he's the deputy, and, you know, people, particularly in Africa, generally, you know, you have the president and then you usually have the deputy. And so that is quite likely. Also, you know, he is a remarkably robust person. He was trained in China. He was in jail with Mugabe. Released in 1974, nearly executed because he was too young, becomes Minister of Defence. I mean, you know, this is somebody, he's really substantial, as opposed to Grace, who really, what is she? Mm. I mean, she's Mugabe's wife and was his former secretary and former lover. Well, you know, big deal.
So a formidable character, formidable enough, though, to follow in the footsteps because, you know, Mugabe is, what, in his early 90s now, I think?
93, yes.
93. I mean, you know, the succession story will be told, one imagines, probably sooner rather than later. You have these despotic leaders. You know, it's a hard act to follow. A strong man, a compelling character, but enough of a character to, what, continue the regime as we know it now?
I'm sure that things will change, and, you know, it's impossible to tell how characters will shift the balance once they're in. They hide their light under a bushel so carefully because, you know, that's the one thing they can't ever do, is to show what they'll really do when they get into power. But Zimbabwe is in a deeply difficult place. The whole land redistribution process has failed, really. They were a net exporter of agricultural products. Now they import. They can't feed their towns. The road systems are collapsing. Many of the other systems are falling apart. You may be able to live in your little rich ghetto, but how long can that go on for? You still have to get basic facilities and things have to work. So it's really, really hard to see how it can continue indefinitely. As you point out, Robert Mugabe can't last forever, even if he sucks the blood of virgins every morning to keep him going.
Jacob, it is interesting, isn't it? We talked about a couple of sort of succession stories, whether it's, you know, what happens to the Democrats once Hillary lost, and here in Zimbabwe with Mugabe, the sort of tyrannical non-Nigerian, what happens next? Do you think there's ever a danger that, you know, we journalists and others who are looking on at these succession stories, we find them compelling, but presumably, you know, the challenges Martin describes, they're so immediate on the ground in Zimbabwe, it does matter to everybody, right? In terms of how the succession process is managed as much as the personnel.
Yeah, I mean, the process question is really important. And to some extent, I mean, you do see sort of familial succession in a variety of countries around the world. And this is actually good because it gives me an opportunity to correct something. I'd said Mario Cuomo earlier. Mario Cuomo is the previous governor of New York. Andrew Cuomo, his son, is the current governor of New York.
There you go. So succession's a bit of a motif.
Exactly. It's the theme of the show. But I mean, there was an interesting thing with North Korea where before or at the moment when Kim Jong-un took over from Kim Jong-il, a variety of political scientists sort of popped up and said, no, country, no sort of modern country has ever survived a three-generational transition within the same family. And yet North Korea proved that it was possible. And of course, you know, not to credit Kim Jong-un with anything beyond sort of extreme willingness to use force against his father's former trusted aides. But I mean, there is a process. If you are willing to be ruthless enough and sort of have a good enough understanding of the dynamics, which can be passed on through family experience or it can be passed on through study or through a variety of mechanisms, that's what matters. It's not even so much necessarily the experience or the sort of personality.
Let's talk a little about military experience next. What about when your military is due for a makeover? Well, there's one official in the Afghan army you'd best avoid. A new report shows that the United States spent almost $30 million more than was necessary on camouflage uniform for Afghanistan's National Army due to the personal taste of just one official. It's understood he preferred a shade of forest green, despite the nation's terrain being largely desert. And worse, the US Defense Department owns several similar patterns that could have been used, apparently, for nothing. Martin Plough, not the first example of a wasteful military procurement decision being made, but a particularly ridiculous one.
Oh, it completely ridiculous. I mean, I've been up on the border. I've never been into Afghanistan, but I've been up on the border with Pakistan. And I mean, the area is definitely not jungle. Definitely, I can vouch for that. And, you know, the idea that you could dish out these uniforms and they'd be fine is ridiculous. But, you know, what is so fascinating is the detail with which the camouflage is now produced. And, you know, each different section of the military now has a slightly different one. And they all swear that they're the absolute bee's knees. They really are going to do the business. And I'm sure they're all wonderful. You know, as you say, there are gargantuan mistakes that are made in the military expenditure. And this must be a drop in the ocean.
Jacob, but how does the US end up spending $30 million more than it needs to? Surely somewhere there's an accountant or one of these box ticker types who we all know who would say, whoa, hang on a minute.
There is an accountant. The problem is the accountant looks the expenditure after it's been made and says, why did we spend $28 million? And you do get, I mean, you know, to what Martin was saying, I mean, the U.S. Navy, for example, has its BDUs, its battle dress uniforms, which are pixelated, high-tech pixelated blue camouflage, which is great, except for the part where when a sailor falls into the water, it makes them impossible to spot. And it's not as though wearing camouflage on the crew is going to make the ship harder to spot. So I'm not sure that necessarily military effectiveness is always the only consideration, even when the military is buying uniforms for itself.
But don't you remember when there was a spanner that was bought, or was it a hammer that was bought by NASA for the, you know, for the space program, and it was something like, you know, $300 spanner, and it was just a spanner.
And therein lies some sort of message, I'm quite sure. Time is short, but just before the end of the program, we did want to mention that for lovers of Italian cuisine, there's good news. Genoa's Cristoforo Colombo Airport has decided to waive the 100ml maximum limit on liquids, as long as that liquid is pesto. More power to them, I say. Jacob, very briefly, do you welcome that news? And if you could re-legalise anything to be taken on board in an over 100ml amount, what would it be?
For my personal basis, it's contact lens solution. It's really frustrating to have to check a bag just for contact lens solution.
Very nice. Martin Plough, pesto? Pesto enthusiast? Would that be what you would choose, or something different perhaps?
I think I would. I think it's a very good idea. Or even the olive oil that went into it is absolutely brilliant.
But do they make you test it? That's the question.
Yes,
do they?
I must say, would you believe the x-ray machine that just diagnoses that it's pesto? I wonder.
It depends. If I was allowed to taste some of it with some nice bread or focaccia or something like that,
I don't think that's what they do.
Possibly not. But they need to look into that at the airport. That ridiculously brings us to the end of today's programme. Big thanks to Martin Plough and Jacob Perkulis. Gentlemen, thank you both for being on the show. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Charlton, and our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music for you next at 1900. The Urbanist is on its way, and we'll have more on all the big stories of the day, and maybe some of those slightly lighter ones as well, on the Daily 2200. Andrew Muller in the chair for that. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. Do join us for that. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for tuning in.